Hi, and welcome to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Dave Bedard. Last week, government agencies in both Canada and the U.S. put out their latest acreage estimates, and we'll take a look at what effects, if any, all this data might have on the markets.
Last week, all of the markets were bullish and prices were going higher.
Also, with a federal price on carbon emissions not only set but rising, we're going to talk about what farmers maybe might expect to be paid for taking those emissions out of the air.
The credits don't pay for the change right now. Right now, it's a little bit more about farm resilience.
And with too many question marks and not enough exclamation points, plans for another major farm event in Ontario have had to be canceled.
The last thing anybody wants to be as a super spreader event.
All that's coming your way on Between the Rows right after this.
Part of being a farmer is being an accountant and a mechanic and a chemist. You have lots on the go. So FarmLink makes your grain marketing go further. We help you reach your financial goals with calculated sales decisions. No bias, just solutions and results. Plus, with our new app, GrainFox, we bring every opportunity right to your fingertips. Literally. Start seeing the returns that'll get your family ahead. You've earned it. FarmLink. Your work is worth more. Get started at farmlinksolutions.ca.
So this past week, dropping right into the middle of the weather concerns that have been looming pretty large over North America's grain and oilseed markets in recent weeks, we've been seeing a couple of new attempts made at estimating how many acres of what crops are growing out there. And to talk us through those, we have Phil France-Workington here from Glacier Markets Farm. Phil, hi, and welcome back to Between the Rows.
Hi, Dave. Thanks for having me.
Well, glad to have you as always. Now, it's Tuesday, July 6th as we speak, and let's back up a bit to June 29th. Statistics Canada releases its latest estimates for principal field crop areas. So given what canola has been doing in recent months, I'm sure a few people in the industry are waiting to see whether canola acreage estimates were revised upward or downward. I mean, did they get what they expected?
Yeah, the canola acreage numbers were pretty much in line with expectations. The acres came in at 22.5 million acres. That was up about a million from the prospective estimates back in the spring. And so that was kind of in line with what people had expected, given the high prices we've seen the past few months, that a few extra acres went into canola, but rotational issues and whatnot could only see the so much of an increase. So that million acre increase was in line with expectations. So at 22.5, that's up 2 million from last year. So a pretty sizable acreage base on canola out there this year, at least.
Mm-hmm. So had this already been baked into canola values by the time the report actually came out, if that's what everybody was expecting?
Yeah, the report was pretty much as far as the canola area. Most crops actually were within line with expectations, so not really that big of a shock to the system as far as the markets goes, mainly confirming what everyone had expected.
Mm-hmm. Now, just sticking with StatsCan for a second, though, obviously these extra canola acres have got to come from somewhere. Which crops are losing ground this year by StatsCan's estimation?
Well, it's mainly, summer fallow. They're pretty much anything that could be planted was planted. And there was, some adjustments in some areas, a bit less wheat, I think, on the year, and, bits here and there from other crops. But there was more barley and more... The pulses, peas, lentils were pretty much unchanged on the year. So it was just kind of small amounts here and there, which I guess added up to the larger canola base.
Mm-hmm. So now let's skip ahead a day to June 30th. That's when USDA up and released its latest plantings estimates, and those did seem to take the trade a bit more by surprise than the StatsCan numbers did, if the response that we saw at least that day in the futures was any indication.
Yeah, that was definitely a shock to traders. Soybean number, especially as far as acres go, the USDA left their estimate unchanged from their earlier guess. And, whereas the thoughts had been just like canola, oh, prices are strong, we're going to seed more soybeans than original thought. But USDA left their number unchanged. So that was 87.6 million acres. So that was unchanged from earlier guesses, but still up by over 4 million acres from last year. So larger soybean area overall, but not as big as expected. Expectations had been for at least 1 or 2 million more acres of soybeans given the prices. So the supplies are tight on beans. So that's that gave that market a quick boost when the number came out. Corn as well. They did revise their corn number a bit higher from earlier guesses, and it's up. It's up on the year, but by about 2 million acres, 92.7 million overall. But the trade had expected an even larger corn crop than that. So the number didn't live up to expectations. So corn prices shot up higher in reaction to that. And as with beans as well, supplies were or quarterly stocks were much tighter at this time of year compared to last year. So there's that sent the corn market higher. So everything last week, all of the markets were bullish and prices were going higher. And we were in the middle of a heat wave as well, which sort of contributed to everything moving up.
Mm-hmm. Now, looking at the effects of the U.S. futures on Canadian crop markets, you know, obviously U.S. soybeans are considered, you know, to be an influence on canola as well as soybeans up here, of course, and wheat and corn on those markets up here, of course. But you know, to what extent is that still a factor given the weather that we're seeing right now up here relative to down there?
Yeah, they're definitely still connected. But mentioning the weather, the heat and dryness and drought conditions we're seeing in the prairies are definitely providing more support for canola, relatively speaking. Canola prices are still relatively strong compared to soybeans in the U.S. But at the same time, it doesn't operate in a vacuum. So today we're talking Tuesday and everything came falling down today with forecasts calling for falling rain in the U.S. So Western Canada might be getting a bit of moisture out in Alberta and Saskatchewan, not much here in Manitoba, but and definitely in need of more rain. But in the U.S., the Midwest and even the Dakotas, where it's been the driest, are forecast to see some much more moisture, and that's sent their futures correcting lower this week, and that's spilling into the canola market as well, even though we could use some more moisture.
Mm-hmm. Now, the Dakotas, I mean, they've been as dry as dust lately, and, you know, and now they're getting some rain, but is it too late? I mean, what are we hearing about the actual practical effect on the crop?
Yeah, the it being too late is definitely the idea. At this stage, the moisture is more of stopping any more declines rather than boosting yields to any effect. So it'll save what is there, maybe if there's a rain at this stage, but to get any more crop at this time is unlikely. And similar situation here in some cases, I think, with rains maybe boosting bushel weights and that kind of thing, but maybe not leading to that much of an increase in yields. But it's still earlier here compared to there. There's more time for our growing season than in the, you know, they're always a bit farther ahead than us. Look at some of the pictures out of North Dakota. There's not a lot of crop there that could be saved by a rain in some cases. So that's been very supportive for spring wheat prices the past the weeks or two, because they grow there. The spring wheat futures in the States follow the what's happening in the Dakotas very closely, and so that's been quite supportive for spring wheat. But that, you know, even though the rain might not fix anything at this point, just the talk of it was enough to send prices lower in the futures markets, at least.
One last thing, just looking at the even bigger picture, you know, on top of the weather, there have been folks looking at what this means for global, you know, grain and oilseed stocks. You know, I read there was one fellow in the US saying, you know, there was no margin of error for bad weather, and there's been bad weather, you know, and in the US acres are being cut. If it sounds like I'm going over the top here, I mean, when people talk out loud about global grain supplies these days, you know, are they talking about it just, you know, within terms of the price inflation we're expecting to see on other goods and commodities, like we've all been expecting anyway? Or, you know, I mean, you know, there was some discussion of when during the last price spike, you know, and short stocks years ago, you know, that's when we started seeing the talk about, you know, Arab Spring and food riots and mass social upheaval. I mean, what's been sort of the discussion about global grain stocks so far as you've heard?
Yeah, that's a good question, because it's what is the new normal? They're always the thought that, oh, prices are, they've come up, and, you know, they're not going to go down to the same extent. And I think a good caution would be to remember that prices could very easily, you know, see a correction and move down. But at the same time, I think it is, you know, prices are strong on a lot of commodities right now, and supplies are tight. The world demand isn't going away, so there's many factors. The case can be made that, yeah, the demand is there and prices should stay firm, but the focus, keep your focus on that word should, because these markets, anything can come and surprise it and change it. But at the end of the day, the fundamentals do say that the prices are, you know, the demand is there, supplies are tight. There's, you know, enough problems in parts of the world to keep some weather premiums and cautions in those markets. And so all of that are reasons that prices should stay strong. There's that word should again. But the there's other factors at play that may or may not swing things. The speculative traders and that kind of large money flows where they put their focus going forward.
I guess it's time for us to, you know, continue to wait and watch, of course. Phil, many thanks for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Phil Frantz-Workington is with Glacier Markets Farm here in Winnipeg. So for about as long as I've been reporting on this business, we've been talking about ways to compensate farmers for their work in taking carbon out of the air that we all put into it. Lately, of course, here in Canada, as we see the price not only set but rising on carbon emissions, it's only fair that we should also be talking about what farmers get and how and why they get it for handling and storing this suddenly more expensive commodity. And for that, we've got Manitoba Cooperator reporter Gerilyn Wishers back with us. Gerilyn, hi, and welcome back to Between the Rows.
Hi, it's good to be back.
Now, for the cover story of the Canada Day issue of the Manitoba Cooperator, you did a roundup of how the companies we consider to be big ag are starting to roll out programs to pay farmers for their offsets and what farmers need to know about these. Now, of course, I want people to read the article, but I've just got to say I was really glad to see it, because, you know, it seems like the ag sector has just been, you know, they've been talking about this for so long. I'm always really glad to see it discussed, not in the abstract, but as an actual thing that's being done. And with that in mind, I am curious. And what are farmers getting paid for carbon sequestration at the farm gate these days?
Good question. The short answer is, I don't know. at this point, you know, there just isn't a transparent trading of carbon like we have for like wheat and canola and so forth. The only company that I looked at that straight up told producers what to expect is Corteva. But they're at a pilot stage in just a few American states at the moment. They're not in Canada, so it doesn't really count for us. But they say that they'll pay between $5 and $20 an acre or $15 a ton. And that's selling carbon on the private voluntary market. So companies like Pepsi have targets they want to hit for their shareholders, for their buyers, etc. But they're not necessarily required to do so by law. But Corteva is also backstopping that price while they're in their pilot phase. So they can sort of afford to give a nice stable price. And of course, here in Canada, we do have private voluntary markets for carbon. But we also have a fair bit more government intervention. And so, for instance, here in Manitoba, where I am, we don't have any government compliance market for carbon, but Alberta does, at least it does for now. And at the beginning of the year, the Western producer quoted an Edmonton area farmer who said he was getting the equivalent of under $2 per acre. And that was at a time when carbon was, based on the federal price, was $30 per ton. But that federal price of carbon is going to rise. It's $40 a ton now, and it's going to hit $170 a ton by 2030. So at least in theory, the value of these credits is going to rise.
But it sounds like the ask from some of these programs, I mean, it's not just the carbon itself, but the practices that farmers are expected to undertake. That's what's being paid for. And it's not just for simple things that most or even all farmers are doing already. You know, these are things that, you know, farmers might have to go to some expense to do. Am I right?
Yeah. I mean, it's a little bit hard to know because there are actually a lot of farmers in Canada who are already doing no-till, which is one of the things that's like common. Their go-tos was to reduce tillage. And it seems to me, especially not so much here in the Red River Valley where I am, but elsewhere, there's a lot of no-till already. But yeah, they're asking them to reduce tillage to very strictly manage, very intensively manage their nitrogen fertilizer use, and cover cropping has also been mentioned.
Now, does what these programs are paying even cover the cost of the farmer's cost for these practices, though? Or
probably not. Like, again, I didn't get a lot of hard numbers. I listened recently to a talk with Corteva again in the States, but an American farmer there straight up said, and then also the Corteva rep on the call straight up admitted that the credits don't pay for the change right now. Right now, it's a little bit more about farm resilience is kind of the buzzword there. But if you're looking to make some changes anyway, it might be worth your while to get that few bucks per acre. And like I said, in Canada, the price of carbon should go up.
And it's interesting too, though, you know, again, I mean, what the programs seem to be paying for is the practices rather than the carbon itself. But I guess, as you know, as time goes on too, you know, the practices that these programs are looking for, you know, are looking to help pay for will, you know, will also sort of become over time, you know, the bare minimum that the public expects of farmers, you know. So what happens then? I mean, does it sound like farmers are going to get less over time as these practices become more the norm than the exception?
Well, yeah, they are getting paid for those practices up front, but many of these programs, they set baselines and then they follow those up with soil tests at intervals. So if you're not actually sequestering that carbon like their data models show, or if for that matter you're sequestering more than the models would predict, they'll know. And they might also adjust your credits accordingly because of that. And yeah, like, it's unlikely that you're going to get paid for those practices forever. Eventually they're going to become normal. Eventually they're going to kind of limit out on how much they can sequester. And that will just be something you'll have to talk to the company about if you're considering signing a contract.
Now, you mentioned too, of course, that, you know, here in Canada, you know, the federal price on carbon, you know, is, you know, $40 per ton, but by 2030, it's expected to climb up to $170 per ton. You know, does that price and, you know, what the planned increase over time, I mean, does that even factor into what farmers can expect from these sorts of programs?
In theory, yes. So to a layperson like myself, the carbon market, it's a real puzzle at the moment. I kept on hearing this term Wild West thrown about, and that's really not a joke. Everything seems to be up in the air. People are figuring out things on the fly. So I'm not trying to be evasive. This is just really a developing marketplace, and policy is still developing around it. In some cases, I just couldn't find a good answer.
So it still needs this carbon market still needs a sheriff in town, so to speak.
Well, I mean, that's the $100 question, I'm sure. But yeah, I'm thinking that yes, the as the carbon prices go up, then farmers should be able to expect more. But I really can't say that for sure or promise it.
Yeah, you did speak in your article, of course. You spoke not only to some of the companies that have programs or are piloting or developing programs, but you also spoke to folks who've been following these developments and advising farmers on what they should be asking, you know, before they commit to these programs. Can you give an example or two of the sorts of things that farmers should be asking before they commit?
Well, I mean, we were just talking about the rising price of carbon in Canada. And I had spoke to Mario Tenuta. He's the 4R research chair here at the University of Manitoba. And he said to make sure that you ask if the price you're quoted is going to be fixed or floating. You know, are you going to get locked in with whatever the price is now? Or is there a chance that that price will go up? And then he also said to ask, how flexible is the program? Like, what are your options as to which practices to change, or will it have any flex if, say, you know, 1 year you really need to put some iron in the soil and get some ruts or something like that, and you can't stick to no-till, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And then also sit down with the company that wants to buy the credits and really kind of get them to crunch the numbers and ask them those hard questions. Mm-hmm. Look at your farm's current setup and what you're willing to change and ask them, hey, what's this going to yield me in credits?
And it sounds too like, I mean, some of these people, they might not necessarily, you might not necessarily be dealing even with the program themselves, but with like what's been referred to as aggregators, you know, sort of, you know, almost kind of a carbon broker, so to speak.
Yeah. I mean, with the ones that I looked at there, it kind of seems that the company that, or their kind of their representatives are going to be doing that work in the field, but
yes.
But eventually, yeah, there may be you're working with an aggregator instead of, you know, a Corteva rep or a Nutrien mm-hmm. rep or someone mm-hmm. from Farmer's Edge, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and I'm sure this won't be the last time this topic comes up on the show or in the Glacier Farm Media books, but I do appreciate you taking the time to talk about it today. Geraldine, thanks very much.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Geraldine Wichers is a reporter with the Manitoba Cooperator. You're listening to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Dave Bedard. As I made mention of a few seconds ago, it's July 6th here as we speak. I was just watching Game 4 of the Stanley Cup Finals on TV last night and seeing massive throngs of people on the streets of Montreal watching the Habs beat Tampa Bay in overtime. Now, with scenes like that, it can be kind of tough to remember that we're still in pandemic mode here and tough decisions have got to be made one way or the other. And here to talk about one of those, we have Doug Wagner, head of Canada's Outdoor Farm Show with Glacier Farm Media. Doug, hi.
Hi, thank you for inviting us to your show.
Well, we're very glad to have you. Now, we're starting to hear from several major ag events across Canada this year as to whether they'll be able to go ahead with live in-person events this fall or not. And as with respects to Canada's Outdoor Farm Show, which usually runs every September down at Woodstock, Ontario, there's been a decision made. Is that correct?
Yes, actually, we just, weighed all the big things that we got to do to have an outdoor event. And there was enough, roadblocks in our way that it became pretty clear in the last couple of weeks that the right thing to do was going to have to be to cancel for 2021. And there's a whole lot of reasons, why we had to decide to cancel. Just to mention a few, first of all, like we've all been kind of, especially Ontario, we've been in this lockdown, it seems like, since about December the 26th with a little bit of a break and then right back down to lockdown again. So I think we'd all like to, get out and do some other stuff and even just get together with people that we haven't seen for well over a year now at an outdoor event, in our case, Canada's Outdoor Farm Show. But when you started, taking a look at all the parts and moving parts of a large outdoor event, and not just ours, but all of them, there's a lot of things that you have to take a look at. And
I mean, for sure, the big reason we have our farm show is to get farmers and the manufacturers of, you know, farm goods and services together at one place for a couple of days to do business. For sure, farmers would like to come, exhibitors would like to come. Mm-hmm. Then into exhibitors, there's, you know, just because of a whole lot of things, it takes them, you know, a couple of months to get ready to be here when it's a world-class show like Canada's Outdoor Farm Show is. A lot of our Ontario-based exhibitors are supported by, their American counterparts from south of us. And, of course, Europe, we have a lot of exhibitors that are European-based, and they always, you know, get some assistance from their parent organizations, as well as, you know, into New Zealand, Australia, and lots of other countries around the world that land in here to help out with the show. So in some cases, they couldn't get here, just because of travel restrictions. So that was a big one. Another big one is, they can't even necessarily, especially on the machinery side, you know, they've been telling us almost everything that was built has been sold. And some of the machines that have been built, you know, some of the exhibit people actually ordered them, you know, probably a year ago and have them hiding somewhere just in case there's going to be a show, just so they'd have something, eh? But we understand that's been a challenge, not just here, but at other shows as well. And then you get looking at some of the other stuff here, like just some of the logistics. Tents, that's a big part of our show. We probably have anywhere from 150 to 190 tents here in any one given year, from, you know, 10 by 10s up to our great big ones. But a lot of those tents this year are being used by pop-up vaccine clinics, and, you know, there's lots more people having smaller events in their backyard. So anyways, we were told we could get, you know, some tents, but maybe not as many as we usually get. So that, you know, that would have been right through the industry. And, you know, that was a biggie that was causing us some challenges. Electrical, you know, that I think we could have managed on that one all right. Washrooms, I think we'd have been all there all right. But then you get into this capacity thing, eh? And since Ontario is still in stage two of our opening up deal, there is still restriction on numbers. And you mentioned the Montreal game last night, like, wow. Mm-hmm. You know, there's only 3,500 people inside in an arena that holds something like 20,000, and outside there was a lot of people. And similar to us, there's all kinds of things that are going on around us, you know, that seem to have a huge number, and we're limited to and we can't even get a definition of what is 25% even normal capacity. So when we had a lot of those things against us, it just seemed to be the natural thing to do was to take another year's break and unfortunately cancel the show for another year.
Too many questions and not enough hard answers, unfortunately.
Yep.
Doug Wagner, yep. Thank you very much for your time.
Okay, thanks for having me.
Doug Wagner is president of Canada's Outdoor Farm Show with Glacier Farm Media. Well, that's our time for today, but we'll be back next week with more for you from Glacier Farm Media's family of publications and websites. Thanks again, of course, to this week's guests. You can check out Phil Franz Workington's reporting online at marketsfarm.com, Geraldine Wichers at manitobacooperator.ca, and Doug Wagner's events at outdoorfarmshow.com. You've been listening to Between the Rows. I've been your host this week, Dave Bedard. Thanks for listening.
Part of being a farmer is being an accountant and a mechanic and a chemist. You have lots on the go. So FarmLink makes your grain marketing go further. We help you reach your financial goals with calculated sales decisions. No bias, just solutions and results. Plus, with our new app GrainFox, we bring every opportunity right to your fingertips. Literally. Start seeing the returns that'll get your family ahead. You've earned it. FarmLink. Your work is worth more. Get started at farmlinksolutions.ca.